From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. Along with your call, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, we'll talk about water. How much water should you drink? Where did those recommendations come, and are there new ones? E-cigarettes. They've been in the news all the time. They continue to be in the news. Information about whether or not they are addictive.
And a yummy recipe.
Yes, you say potato salad.
What do I say?
What do you... Potato salad. You've got it. Exactly.
800-462-7413. That's our toll-free number. And we go to the phones now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I've had good results for multiple sclerosis with exercise, but what other things does Dr. Zorba recommend for multiple sclerosis?
Well, first of all, exercise is really a key issue with MS. I mean, it's a very key issue. How long have you had MS?
I was diagnosed in January of 95. It came in as a result of a small stroke or TIA. In July of 94.
Mm-hmm. So a stroke or a TIA you had at that time. And if it left you with some disability, then it definitely was a stroke. Well, first of all, we know exercise is good no matter what disease or problem that you have. And I think in MS, it's especially important because the ability to move and use your muscles is limited by basically how much the nerves are firing. There are myelin sheaths in the nerves, and these myelin sheaths are sort of superhighways. And when they're disrupted, it's just like a highway is disrupted in terms of how the nerves hit the muscles.
What did you call those things?
Well, they're myelin. It's called myelin, and it's the outside of the nerve. Certain nerves have a coating of myelin, and as I said, it kind of gets the nerve impulses to go quickly. And in MS, it's a demyelinating disease. These particular sheaths, these nerve fibers, if you will, go mm-hmm. through a transformation. They lose their myelin, and basically they don't work as well. So any exercise is good. You exercise by yourself or with someone else?
Well, right now, I get on an omnicycle a couple, two, three times a week, but I haven't been able to get on the last 3 weeks because I have an issue with both little toes. But when I was bicycling, I bicycled L.A. to Vancouver and back 3,000 miles in 2 months, 45 miles a day, and I felt extremely happy and healthy.
I bet you did. When did you do that? You did that after you had your MS?
Oh, no, that was after MS. I was diagnosed in January of 95, but I was staying in Los Angeles, and I could bicycle up to 40 miles a day with a rest stop in between. In 96. In 97, I booked 17 speeches from LA to Vancouver and back, and including, you know, to make the next speech three times, I had to ride 150 miles to get to the next speech.
Pretty amazing. What were the speeches on?
On natural recovery from MS. I had a website on MS that, you know, had a basic three areas. First, you had to believe and the positive attitude. And then exercise was the second most important thing. And then supplements and sunlight. Sunlight's very good for MS.
You know, I think you really hit it on the head with everything that you've said. First of all, a belief in the future that the future has something to hold for you is really what motivates people to do anything in the first place. They feel like the future is bad, they stop doing things, and if you have MS, it's associated, as you know, with depression. MS and depression are intimately linked together. We don't know if it causes depression or if it's just a side effect of the MS in some fashion, but it's very common. Exercise, always good, no matter what you have. And sunlight, the supplements are always, we always wonder about them, but I don't think anyone wonders about sunlight. Right, Tom? Sunlight is always good for anything you have. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Really appreciate it.
We appreciate the call.
A paradigm. Here it is. You come out with MS, you start biking, and you say, look, I'm biking, and I'm speaking, and I'm talking about MS, and I'm going from one spot to another. What a wonderful...
It's kind of an amazing story.
Yeah, it's an amazing story for people to actually say, hey, if you can bike with MS, maybe I have MS, I can do something. Maybe not 50 miles a day because you can do it, but maybe I can do 5 miles or 2 miles or even 1 mile, but I can do something.
I don't know if I could get the bike out of the garage. 800-462-7413. That's our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi. How you doing, Tom? Hi, Zorba. And special yell-out to Carl.
Our producer. Don't do that sort of thing. He gets a big head.
That's right. That's right.
He's great. I've got a room for him down here in the winter up front. It's all ready for him to go, him and his wife and the baby. I'm telling you. In 1966, I put my left eye out with a screwdriver, was rushed to a hospital, and they were scraping the fluid off my hand and off my face, wherever they could get it. And they called a doctor in. He came in and he said, look, son, you've lost 50%, more than 50% of the fluid. We've never saved an eye that far gone. I begged him because I had just worked with a guy with a glass eye and it just looked horrible. Mm-hmm. And so I begged him. I said, please, just give it a try. You know, and of course, they'd already shot me up with something and I was pretty well lit. Uh-huh. But 12 hours later, 80-some-odd microscopic stitches and 6 weeks in a halo in the hospital, and the thing started growing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, there were hormones involved. I really don't know what they were. Sure. But I had an attendant 24-7. You know, there were three or four people who lit. I was blinded during this entire time. Mm-hmm. But they would light my cigarettes and flick the ashes in a hospital.
They would light your cigarettes and flick the ashes. Yeah. That's the day.
Anyway, it got. I came out of it with a patch for about 3 years. It looked very horrible. It looked like a snow pea. It was really quite ugly. But it did grow. But he said I'd probably never see again. Mm-hmm. Well, I did have a limited, you know, tunnel vision and limited sight, mostly colors. The right eye, I guess, made up for most of it. In 1980, I was going in on a general, you know, having been checked up, this doc said to me, another doc said, you've got a detached retina there. Mm-hmm. So I still have the buckle, which back then, I guess, was primitive, but it worked. I got my sight back into where I could focus and all of that.
Wow.
I could see very well.
Incredible.
But, yeah, then I had a cataracts operation, and it now, other than being still tunnel vision, I have sight. I read,
that,
I do everything.
That is fantastic. That means the first doc really saved your eye. You know, when the eye was punctured and the vitreous fluid was coming out of the eye, that's probably what it was. The vitreous, which is most of the fluid in the eye, was coming out. And then technology improved, and they gave you a buckle, which is what they just started doing in the 80s for retinal detachment. Yep. They did a little bit before then. So the technology improved, so that allowed your eye to be fixed even more. And here it is, you have tunnel vision, but the reality is your fovea, where you have to do fine work, can be seen. Well, you are a champion of modern medicine, modern ophthalmology.
Well, the last year I had a detached retina in the right eye.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And so my big question is, should I be aware or change my lifestyle or do anything? I was a carpenter all my life.
Uh-huh.
And how I got the last detached retina was I needed a new knee, and I kept falling down. And during one of these times that I fell down, I detached the retina in my right eye. Now I'm a little afraid.
I don't think there's, you know, detached retinas come no matter what. I mean, they just happen. They're the shape of the eye. There's certain risk factors for them. And having one detached retina is a risk factor for having another one, although yours probably was traumatic in nature. So
yeah.
I don't think you should vary your lifestyle, except you should always wear, you know, safety glasses when you're doing anything.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty obvious
when you're doing
anything that can do it. But no, I think, hey, you've got vision in one eye, you've got vision in the other eye, you're living, you keep up the good work. I think you're doing everything right. A miracle of modern medicine. That's what you are.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. Well, thank you, Doc.
Thanks for sharing that. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate the call. Two kind of interesting, exciting calls to start off the show. Biking 45 miles a day with MS.
My goodness.
And then
my goodness.
Blindness
coming into sight. Yes, my goodness. Kind of a celebration. But that's good. Sometimes it's wonderful to look at what we have, and these are two great examples.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. And now, Zorba, before our next call, a topic we've talked about from time to time on the program, how much water should you drink every day to stay healthy and hydrated?
Well, you know, this is a question that has vexed me for years. Who came up with the 8 glasses a day? And by the way, what is a glass? Is it 6 ounces?
Yeah.
Is it 8 ounces? Is it 12 ounces? If you look at it, somebody, you know, sort of came up with this concept back in the 30s when a juice glass was probably about 6 ounces or so. Hmm. So what do you think a glass is?
What do you mean?
Well, is it 8 ounces?
Well,
10 ounces? 12 ounces?
Yeah.
So then there's the idea that when you drink water, you're flushing your kidneys. Well, we flush a toilet. You know, we push it down and water comes running through. You don't really flush your kidneys.
I think the idea was you should have a lot of water, as you say, to keep things flowing.
Flowing. What a concept. Like keep with our kidneys. We don't think about it keeping things flowing with our blood, right? Or keep the circulation flowing in our brain.
Blood is always circulating around.
Our brain. If
you didn't have any blood, then you wouldn't have any blood.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Same with water.
You would just go.
I don't know.
So the Harvard newsletter said, well, maybe we don't need 8 glasses. Maybe we need 6 glasses. Never, of course, saying exactly what a glass was. You know, I think a lot of this idea behind drinking lots of water comes from the water industry that has invented plastic bottles to give us water that tastes like water.
Because that came along a long time before.
It came before it, but it has really hit since.
Well, why does Harvard say now it's 6 glasses?
Well, you know, there's no basis for this, absolutely no basis. So I'll tell you what I figured out. First of all, do not get dehydrated. Number one, do not get dehydrated. Yeah. Now, if you're out there on a golf course hitting a golf club and it's a hot day, bring something with you because you are likely to be dehydrated. Same if you're in a marching band. Same if you're in a marathon because you can't depend upon thirst when you don't have water available to you. That's really important. Or when you're simply doing something, you're concentrating and not thinking about that. Look at your urine. If it's dark, that means you're dehydrated, and move it so that it's light. We all know what light urine looks like. Tea-colored, that means you've got enough water in you. And pay attention to thirst. In other words, if you're thirsty, drink. And if you're not thirsty, you probably don't have to be crazy about it. But again, look at your urine and see heat. Normally, let's say your urine is dark, that means you probably should lighten it up by drinking more water. I'm much more for the idea of checking your own body and seeing what it does than simply rock-stepping to the 4, 6, 8 glasses of 6, 10, 12, 14 ounces a day. Watch your body, and it will take care of you.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. And to Buffalo, New York we go. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how can we help?
Well, I'm 58 years old. When I was 15, I was hit by a speeding car. It did a number of things, but majorly it broke my left side of my hip socket and blew out my right knee.
Wow.
So for years, they reset the knee. I've been using the right leg as my stability factor because without a hip socket on one side, I don't, you know, that left leg, the muscles atrophy, I don't use much. And doctors have been giving me anti-inflammatories for years.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, I started to read about, you know, in all these different publications you find in doctor's offices and in different magazines, the health part of magazine says take ginger and red pepper. I started taking red pepper,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hurting more and more and more, And somebody said to me, you're allergic to eggplant. You're probably allergic to pepper, too, because they're in the nightshade family. Well, I'd never heard such a thing. And looking it up, I don't find peppers listed in the nightshade family. I wonder what's up with this.
Well, I don't really think the red pepper is making your hip socket hurt more. That's kind of the first thing. I can't imagine how it would do it. I can't imagine what the relationship would be to actually do that. So that would be it. I mean, I'd have to look up the nightshade family myself, but you know, a lot of people have this belief that...
Did I hear you right? Wasn't the red pepper to heal the knee pain?
Yeah, but your pain is getting worse.
The red pepper is supposed to be an anti-inflammatory, mm-hmm. but in people who are allergic to things, especially nightshade family plants are supposed to be poisonous to one degree or another. It definitely are toxic more so to some people than others.
I don't know if there's any science behind that at all. So I will not assume that. I won't assume that plants in the nightshade family, I'd have to look it up, I can't remember which ones they are actually toxic for you, nor can I imagine that they actually do anything for inflammation. But did you stop taking your anti-inflammatory and then your pain got worse?
Well, the pain did get worse, and they gave me an x-ray and said, mm-hmm. oh, no new damage after a fall. And then a year later, when I really can't move and in intense pain, they did an MRI, and they said, oh, you have torn both your meniscus have tears in them, and there's dislocation, and there's cartilage destruction. Oh, wow. There's a lot more going on here than the regular x-ray
Well, the regular x-ray doesn't show that stuff. MRIs show it. And they're very useful if they help either determine what the pain is from, as in your case, or if they alter treatment. So getting back to your pain issue, I would look at different anti-inflammatories, cycle through them. If naproxen doesn't work, ibuprofen, those are both over-the-counter. Double, of course, what is on the bottle, because what's on the bottle is a low dose. So it's two Aleve tablets twice a day, or four ibuprofen three times a day. Or try one of the prescription anti-inflammatories, see if that works. Little physical therapy might work, stretching exercise. Sometimes chiropractic will work for this. But I think the red pepper is failed, and I would give it up.
Did you say that red pepper fix came from a magazine in a doctor's office?
Well, yes, in different,
I'm just thinking that magazine in the doctor's office was probably about 30 or 40 years old. So,
you mean because doctors' magazines are always
that may have been true a long time ago, but probably not.
No, they're just in the little health recommendations and like the AARP and different magazines.
Okay.
You know the.
How much did your red pepper cost?
Housekeeping and stuff.
Did you buy capsules? Red pepper capsules?
No, I didn't buy the capsules. I bought red pepper in a can little spoonfuls and mixed it with ketchup.
Oh gosh,
it's, palatable then.
Okay. Red pepper and ketchup.
Well, I'm in Buffalo. You know, we're the chicken wing town, so everything is coated with red pepper and butter here.
I love it. Red Pepper City. That's what Buffalo is, Red Pepper City.
It is.
Thanks a lot. Good luck. Anti-inflammatory, I would try that. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a dive into the murky waters of medical quackery in our newest segment we call Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba. Okay, Zorba, let's talk about the history of ultraviolet light treatment, sometimes known as violet ray generators.
That's right. They were really common, and they were common in before penicillin was invented in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. My mom had one. Actually, it was her grandmother's, and these were devices, different kinds of devices. They had ultraviolet light. If you remember years ago, ultraviolet light was common in bars to get rid of the smell of smoke. It actually produced ozone, and but these were, you know, lights that were sort of guarded. This one, you stared right at it. You put on goggles that had these very thick, dark glasses. That's what I remember. And you looked at that, and you had to stare into this light for about 15 minutes. And the idea was the light would get rid of it. It would improve your immunity. It would get rid of your disease, and it would make you better. So you sit in front of
this ultraviolet light. Putting on goggles and looking at
the light. You had to look at the light. And it was on a timer. It was a big contraption that would be on a timer, and it would time for 15 minutes. And it was the most boring thing in the world. Imagine being 9 years old. old and having your mother put you in a dark room then with this bright light and goggles and said, stare, don't do anything else, then she would probably stare
at me.
And
what was this supposed to cure?
Make me better, get rid of my, keep my colds from happening, keep me from getting pneumonia, meningitis,
so you actually
diphtheria, polio.
Thing.
I had to use it. But ours was a combination of ultraviolet light and sun lamp. So basically, okay. I sat in front of it, my face would turn red, and sometimes it would blister. And she thought that was good. Blistering skin meant I was getting enough ultraviolet light to give me a healthy glow. No concept of skin cancer in those days, not at all. But I think once again, ultraviolet light and staring into it with 15 minutes doesn't do anything and goes into the annals of medical quackery.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this news segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
Stick around. Our recipe is coming up next. More of your calls, of course. And we'll take some more of your emails, too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, you say potato salad.
That's right. I say potato salad. Right. Exactly. Exactly. But potato salad is wonderful, especially this time of year. But frankly, any time of year. We eat potato salad in the summer, in the winter, in the fall, in the spring. We eat more in the summer because, I don't know, you eat more in the summer. You know, it's just sort of a summer dish. But it's always good to look at variations on this. So we're going to give you one variation that we take care of, and then you can vary it yourself. How does that sound?
That sounds good. Okay.
So start out with 2/3 of a cup of light sour cream.
2/3 of a cup light sour cream.
Now, you could also use light Greek yogurt, plain Greek yogurt, which is light. You wouldn't have any Greek yogurt that had any flavoring in it, obviously. And that will give something that's tangier. But the whole idea is to cut out the fat calories for that.
Okay.
1/2 cup of your favorite light salad dressing.
1/2 cup light salad dressing.
That's right. So you pick out a light salad dressing you like. Doesn't make a difference what it is. It might be light ranch. It might be a light vinaigrette. Hmm. It's something that you like the taste of. 4 dashes of hot pepper sauce.
4 dashes of hot pepper sauce.
You are smiling with that, Tom.
Well, I'm just, the idea of a dash, how much is a dash?
That's it. That's a dash.
Okay.
You make those little kind of sounds.
What do you do?
That's exactly it. Yeah. Well, with my Tabasco sauce, I have no idea what a dash is. But if I go like this, I'm doing it with my hand. Nobody can see what I'm doing right now. It's a dash. But we know what a dash is.
Yeah,
you know what a dash
is.
2 tablespoonfuls of skim milk, but any milk you have around the house will work. Mm-hmm.
2 big tea milk.
4 large russet potatoes, peeled, cooked, and cubed.
4 large russet potatoes, peeled, cooked, and cubed.
2 1/2 cups of fresh broccoli florets cut into bite-sized pieces.
2 1/2 cups fresh broccoli florets cut into bite-sized pieces.
1/3 cup of sliced green onions.
1/3 cup of sliced green onions.
And 1/2 cup of shredded cheddar cheese.
1/2 cup shredded cheddar cheese.
Sound interesting?
Yeah, it does.
It really does. Sounds interesting. So in a large bowl, stir together the sour cream or the Greek yogurt, salad dressing, hot pepper sauce, and milk. Then gently stir in the potatoes that obviously have been cooked, the broccoli, the green onion, and the cheese, and these are all good. And the broccoli does not have to be cooked. The broccoli, I would recommend not being cooked at all, in fact. 1/3 cup of, you know, the green onions that you put in there also, and then cover and refrigerate for 2 to 3 hours before serving. And if you want to garnish with parsley or garnish with bacon bits or garnish with kale or garnish with dill or garnish with chives, but it's always nice to garnish something on the top.
This is a very simple recipe, and
yes.
It sounds like a really, really good recipe.
It really is. You know, because you've got broccoli in there, it gives you a little bit of crunch, and it tastes good. Green onions, and of course, the cheddar cheese changes it. And then, you know, normally we use mayo. Here we're using light sour cream or Greek yogurt. It's good. And I bet a lot of people would like this recipe.
Yeah. Well, they probably have memorized all the ingredients.
Absolutely. But if you haven't memorized the ingredients, come to our website, ZorbaPastor.org. You can see that. Photos of Tom, search through other recipes. Do wonderful things on it. That's ZorbaPastor.org. Or find us through Facebook. And remember, I tweet.
800-462-7413, the number if you have a question for Zorba. And Zorba, our next listener has been waiting in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, my name's Debbie. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. How can we help?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, you had talked about people using EpiPens, going to the emergency room, and so on. My question is, I carry an EpiPen because the wasps love me, and they love to send me to the emergency room.
Yeah,
exactly. But what I'm wondering is, I usually dose up before I go out there, take my Benadryl, take my allergy meds. Now, if I was to get stung and I use the EpiPen, do I need to immediately go to the hospital? Or because I've maybe taken all those allergy meds and used the EpiPen, is it necessary or can I wait a little bit, see if my reaction is going to be very bad? I'm just looking at cost of going to the emergency room.
Oh,
it's
yes.
Not necessary versus just running there.
Oh, right. I agree with you. First of all, let's talk about the reaction you initially had and how often do you get stung? So what kind of a reaction had you had in the past?
Oh, well, a couple of years ago, I'd get stung, I'd take some Benadryl, and I'd just wait it out, be fine. The last year, I got stung. The bee just sat on my ankle and literally bit me 10 times. And then that one was over with. I swelled up. I didn't stop breathing or have problems with
good.
The breathing.
Mm-hmm.
But the next time, within a week, I went out, reached over my flowers, and got stung on the underside, the soft part of your arm. That time, I waited and waited, took my meds, and I'd been talking to a friend. They're like, you don't sound right. You should go. So I went. That's the first time my tongue swelled and my eyes swelled. So they did the whole rundown with the epinephrine and so on.
Sure.
Also had the reaction a month ago from some cats. I'm a little concerned.
Well, you are concerned. A couple of suggestions here. First of all, you're right taking an antihistamine when you're working in your garden. I have a question. I have a garden. I don't seem to get stung as much. Do you have a lot of bees around your house that are stinging you?
It comes and goes. Last year was an epidemic of wasps for everyone. The year before was bad. This year not so bad, so I have one of those electronic tennis things, those whackers for the bugs. And let me tell you, those are a godsend.
Oh, the whackers, the electronic tennis whacker. You've got one too, Tom?
No,
is that what you're doing?
No, but I know about.
Yeah, the electronic whackers. I use it when we have flies in the house. I'll go whack it. My wife doesn't like it because Penny says it makes a buzz. And she goes, just doesn't like the buzz. But I love it because I know that bug is not going to bother us. Be that as it may, I would recommend doing what you're doing. You know, before you go out, take some antihistamine. Make sure it's in there for an hour. Do you tolerate Benadryl during the daytime?
I don't really have that much of a problem with it. I can work through it.
It's the best stuff. You know, Benadryl is the best stuff. And I would do the EpiPen. I wouldn't rush to the ER.
Oh, good.
I mean, the EpiPen is great. Get stung, use the EpiPen. That's most likely it. Now, the real issue is, are you developing more and more severe allergies? So if we look at it globally, yes, the last time your tongue swelled up and you had a greater allergy. If you start to get short of breath, obviously, then you've got to get to the ER right away. But usually the adrenaline will take care of it. The other issue is whether or not, if this continues, if you should go through desensitization therapy. And there is reasonably good desensitization therapy for wasps and bee venom that's out there now. But I would consider that if you continue to have trouble.
How does that work?
Well, you get small amounts of shots, you know, on a very regular basis in an allergist's office, and the body then does not have that same florid reaction to the venom when the venom goes in your body. Bee venom, wasp venom, hornet venom, if we look at that venom versus snake venom, there are about 2 to 3 deaths a year from snake venom, and there are 400 to 500 deaths from insect venom,
Whoa.
Essentially. So it's really much more of a dangerous issue than snake venom. But you're doing the right thing. Have your EpiPen with you. If you get shot, give yourself a shot with the EpiPen. I wouldn't wait. If you get stung by a bee, I would use the EpiPen, even though that has side effects, you know, of a fast pulse and so on.
Well, wonderful. I thank you so much for your help, and I'm going to take into consideration the desensitization as well.
Take care. Thanks for your call. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413.
You know, you and I have a very good friend who has a wonderful, wonderful garden. And it's just, she's a master gardener. And it's one of the most beautiful home gardens, if not the most beautiful home garden I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
And she periodically gets stung. But I don't think there are a lot of wasps around that particular flower garden. And this woman sounds like she's got a wasp infestation. And that, of course, then becomes much more of an issue.
Question for Zorba? 800-462-7413. And a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma is with us now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I got a problem with a skin problem. About 8 years ago, I was stung by a spider at a Rhode Island gate, and I didn't think much of it. And anyway, it developed a little blister, and the doctor treated it later on and used omeprazole furate cream to stop the spread of the blister.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sounds good.
Later, I developed shingles.
Oh, uh-huh.
On my bottom legs.
Mm-hmm.
I had the Zartec belt and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the methylpred OMG pack.
They gave you a methylprednisone, so they gave you steroids when you had your shingles. Okay,
is that what that is?
That's what it is. They're steroids. They're oral steroids. It starts out with a higher dose and then goes to a lower dose. Do they also give you viral medication, antiviral medication?
No.
No. When was that? When did you have your shingles? When was it?
That was in 2007.
Okay, so they didn't give you any antivirals at all. How long after you got the rash did you go and see your doctor?
It took a little while. I took a scolding, and it took a little while before I went in.
You took a scolding from who? From the doctor or somebody else?
The doctor.
The doctor. Okay, the doctor gave you a scolding.
So, but later on, I've developed a skin problem whereby that the skin is... It's tough, rough.
Sure.
Reminds you of an alligator skin.
Uh-huh.
Like it secretes something and solidifies on top.
Uh-huh.
And now it's come to the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
On the right hand especially.
Sure.
I use the thumb as a starting point. It would be very bad on the knuckle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you gone anywhere for that? Have you seen a doctor for that, or family doc, internist, dermatologist?
No, I haven't.
Uh-huh. So you want to try some over-the-counter stuff first?
Yes.
Well, I think it's always a good start. I don't know if this is related to the shingles. You can have changes in the skin from shingles, thickening of the skin, and of course they can be painful long-term. Sometimes it takes months or years for that pain to go away. But if you've got some thickened skin over there, first thing I would do is I would get over-the-counter Aquaphor or Eucerin.
I use the rip-off from Walmart.
Uh-huh.
That compares theirs to Aquaphor.
Excellent, excellent. No reason
to
go.
But it doesn't work.
Well, then if that doesn't work, the next step, have you used over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream?
No.
That's what I would do with my next step. Hydrocortisone cream, and I would try that. And there's only one strength. It's 0.5%. That's the only stuff that's over-the-counter. And I would do some hydrocortisone cream, but I'd put that on probably 2 to 3 times a day. And one of the ways to get it to absorb into that skin better is to get the skin a little wet beforehand. You take a moist washcloth, make it nice and cold, wring it out, put it on top of the skin for maybe a minute or 2 minutes, even 3 or 4 if you can. Kind of moistens up the skin, then put the cream into it. It will absorb better into the skin. Do that 3 times a day. Try that for 10 to 20 days and see if that works. And if not, you may have to call up your doctor for a stronger prescription. But I would try that and see if that softens things up. You know, hydrocortisone cream, it turns out that's 0.5%. I don't think the 1% is available over the counter. If it is, then use that. Go to the pharmacist, get at Walmart. That's fine. Get the highest dose there is. But those moist compresses really can make a difference and help the absorption.
One quick question. What about vitamin E?
Oh, vitamin E oil can work too. That can also soften things up. You get a vitamin E capsule, puncture a hole with a pin. It's an oil, and rub that on top of it. Vitamin E oil can also work quite well. Try both of those.
Better than than anything.
Well, May, you try that or the hydrocortisone. I would try one versus the other. You just pick and see if one works better than the other and then keep it up. See what it does for you. The vitamin E oil, if that works, I would stick with that. I'd probably do that first.
Very good. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Good luck to you. Let us know what happens.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take an email question from a loyal listener named Beth from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. She writes, "Hi, Zorba. On a recent recipe on your show, someone had stevia listed as an ingredient. You made the side comment about Truvia rather than stevia. I'm at a point in my life where I've started to eat less carbs and sugars in my diet. I found this amazing recipe for Caprese balsamic chicken, and part of the recipe calls for Truvia brown sugar blend. I'm not a fan of artificial sweeteners and can't stand the aftertaste, so I wonder if you can give me some insight on this. Do you feel that Truvia is a good choice? A lot of reviews say it does not leave a lingering odd taste, but what is your opinion?"
Well, first of all, I would look and see if you have the lingering taste. You know, people will put sweet and low in their coffee, and to me it has a bitter taste because the saccharin, I would never do it, but if I put in, we'll say, Splenda or NutraSweet, it wouldn't bother me at all. So you've got to, you know, taste is individual. You've got to see what works for you and whether or not the taste is there. But the real question is, if you've got a brown sugar Truvia combination and you're using it on chicken, why is the Truvia at all? I mean, how much brown sugar are you getting on that chicken rub? Are you getting a teaspoon, which is 15 calories, or 2 teaspoons, which are 30 calories? It's like minimal calories. So why bother with the Truvia at all? Why not just go for the sugar and then you don't have to worry about aftertaste? Sort of an example of it's these little things, 15 calories here, 30 calories there. They don't mean as much as the calories you'll get on the chicken skin.
Mm. Have a question or other trivial pursuits for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course. And another one of your emails here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. If you have a question for Zorba, the number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we talk again about e-cigarettes.
Right, e-cigarettes. So, you know, they're a hot topic, and I'm not against e-cigarettes. I want to make that clear. I'm not in favor of e-cigarettes. That's exactly what it is. So people say e-cigarettes have helped me quit and they're safer. Well, the issue is the safety issue. First of all, let's put the kids aside. They should not be available for children under the age of 18, period. Yeah. Every state should pass laws for it. Why? Because they're addictive things. And if we look at middle school and high school, they have just ballooned. There are about 2.5 million students in high school, estimated by the CDC, who are using e-cigarettes now versus in the year 2013. Well, it's an enormous change.
They make them like candy, right?
They make them like candy with these silly flavors like puke, sweet puke. Now tell me, that's one of the most popular brands around, you know, middle school kids. They're sweet and they're sweet tasting, but they also have nicotine, and that's the issue. We know nicotine is an addictive substance, and this was a study that looked at e-cigarettes, looked at what they were labeled at, some actually have labeled, looked at the nicotine concentration, and what they discovered was that the nicotine concentration varied from one to the other, and they might say it has no nicotine, and it had nicotine in it, and it didn't necessarily say how much nicotine it had, and the more nicotine it has, obviously the more addictive it's going to become, because we know that nicotine is the addictive substance. So there are a lot of issues with this. The other issue is, people say, well, I know they're safer than tobacco. Well, how do you know? How do you know they're safer than tobacco? It takes 20 to 30 years, sometimes 40 years to get lung cancer, 30 years to get COPD, 30 years to get heart disease. How do we know these are safer?
I thought the whole point of these was they don't have nicotine in them.
Well, no. The whole point of these is that they don't have tobacco, so you can then use them in places where you can no longer smoke. So people who are smokers can then go at a table in some restaurants and actually blow the e-cigarettes around.
And that's as much nicotine as tobacco.
Well, some of them have as much nicotine. They don't have the other burning ingredients of tobacco. And that's where the manufacturers of e-cigarettes say we're really safer because it doesn't have the additives of tobacco. But you know who owns a lot of the e-cigarettes? They're tobacco companies. They're going where the money is. Yeah. And in stores, you see them over and over again. So I think one of the issues with this newest study is that e-cigarettes should be out of the hands of our children. E-cigarettes are addictive because they have nicotine in them. E-cigarettes to take home, the safety record has not been proven at all. So do not assume that e-cigarettes are safe because there's no proof. The only thing that's safe is pure, clean air with nothing in it.
800-462-7413, the number if you have a question for Zorba. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in DeForest, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Well, I am a 40-year-old woman, and I have I've had two children in the last 3.5 years, and I've sort of lost my way on a regular exercise habit. I did, before the birth of between my first and second child, I did have a 3 to 4 a week, light jogging, walking. I've finally made it a priority to pick that up again, to try to get a run or a walk in 4 times a week. And I discovered that there are tons and tons of Couch to 5K apps on your phone. And so I decided to make it a goal to try to run a 5K. And I loved it for the first 2 weeks.
Excellent,
after the second week, as the running time increased, I started having really achy knees, kind of at the top of my kneecap, about an hour after my run walk. Mm. And it's gotten so bad that I was trying to do 4 days on, 1 day off, and I've actually switched to running every other day. And I've had to take ibuprofen pretty much every day just to kind of help with the achiness. Please do not use the word OLD at all to describe my knees.
Well, OLD is a three-letter word. We don't use three-letter words here. That's what we do. We don't use three-letter words. But getting back to the issue, you know, you've got something going on. You might have a bursitis. You might have, a meniscus. You could have some degenerative arthritis. There are a lot of different things in knees. It doesn't matter if you suffer from OLD or YOUNG. The knees can cause a problem for many people.
Yeah.
And the issue is what to do about it. So are you doing any quad sets? Have you heard of quad sets?
I have, and I am not.
Okay, so we'll put a link on our website, zorbapastor.org, and we'll put a link, either with a YouTube or something like a YouTube to show quad sets. Quad sets are really very, very good for the knee. They strengthen the quad muscles above the knee, and they can give the knee some stability. And 10 sets of these in the morning, 10 sets in the evening can make a big, big difference. Are you actually going to run any kind of a race? Is that your plan?
Yeah, that was my goal, was to actually have that. We've got in our community, we've got a 5K that's coming up, so it was perfect timing.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things you can do also is you can use an anti-inflammatory. You know, you're bothered by it. I would take one over-the-counter Aleve once a day or twice a day and up it to two. And I would probably do it an hour before I went running, at least. Just get that in your system and see how that works. That may help with the inflammation around there. But first thing I would do is I'd hit the quad sets because that may be your answer. And then I'd look at the anti-inflammatory. And I wouldn't put down the fact that you're still going to go on your 5K. You know, you just may have to alter it. It might have to be every other day versus the number of days in a row. That might be another issue. But I would keep it up because often people who suffer from OLD can become YONGER. I hope that makes
sense. No, that's excellent. That's excellent advice. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for your call. Good luck. Good luck in that race, too. Hope you win it.
Thanks. Yes, thanks.
Bye-bye. And before our next call, Zorba, time to let one of our listeners give us a piece of her mind in a segment we call Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's disagreement comes from a listener named Shirley. She writes, on a recent show, Dr. Zorba stated that an EpiPen will last 2 years. I carry an EpiPen, and the instructions state that they need to be replaced every 6 months. Also, I might add, Medicare does not cover the cost of this item.
Oh, well, first of all, then I stand corrected. I thought they lasted for 2 years. But you pay attention to what's on the EpiPen. But also, when you go to the pharmacy, you want to ask them for the EpiPen with the longest duration. So if she had an EpiPen, she or he, mm-hmm. had an EpiPen that was for 6 months, I still don't know if that's the longest duration or if that was the 6 month from that EpiPen. In other words, they may be different. Well, they're different because there may not be a fresh lot of EpiPens. In other words, you want to look at the lot and see when the lot is there. And I don't know if it's, I thought it was 2 years, but I stand corrected if it's 6 months. You know, we'll put on our website, zorbapastor.org, we'll put on the answer for this, for how long EpiPens really last, because I think that's really important. It's also important to pay attention to how they're kept. They tell you exactly how to keep them. Can't be too hot, can't be too cold. That's very important too. So we'll put that information on our website.
If you disagree with something Zorba said, just post it on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook.
The number to call if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. And now Zorba, a Sandpoint, Idaho listener joins us. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, my husband has been diagnosed with diverticulitis, diverticulosis, and it's been getting progressively worse. The last episode put him in the emergency room and was scary and no fun. I have a compound question. Can diverticulitis and diverticulosis heal, and is it reversible? Also, what sort of nutrition should we be doing for him to make sure that we reduce flare-ups? What we have been doing is a gluten-free situation. And the last part of my question is, how detrimental is alcohol to this situation?
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, diverticuli are these pockets in the colon. And most of them, we all have them, pretty much so. Most people in America have them. And then sometimes they get inflamed. They get, a piece of food gets in them or something. We don't know exactly why they get inflamed. Some people, just an antibiotic such as Augmentin and Cipro together can get rid of the inflammation. And that happens most of the time. And then if you look at that from a point of view, about maybe 5% or less, it might even be 1% need surgery. And that's, of course, very significant. So was he given a colostomy for a while at all, or what happened? He had surgery?
No, he did not have surgery. Surgery has been recommended, and that's what we want to avoid at all costs.
Has he had more than one episode?
Yes, multiple episodes. Stretching back now, we realize for years.
Okay, so he's had lots of episodes. So, first of all, we used to say no seeds, no nuts, and that turns out not to be true. There's no evidence. We thought seeds and nuts get stuck there, and that was an old doctor's tale, a medical myth. So you can have seeds and nuts. The theory is a high roughage diet would be useful. Metamucil every day is thought to be really good. It's a great way to get bulk, insoluble bulk. And so that's what I recommend to my diverticular patients. Take a scoop of Metamucil in the morning, and basically you'll be reducing, you'll sort of brush out your colon. I'm sure that's not actually what happens, but we know that fiber, such as from Metamucil, may be helpful. And then if it continues to happen, then you look and say, well, is surgery really recommended? It depends on how often it happens. And it sounds like he's had some bad episodes, within the diet. So I wouldn't limit things. I would increase roughage and I would add Metamucil. When do they recommend the surgery?
Well, they have recommended it earlier in the year, and our viewpoint on that was, well, we need to try a few alternatives before we go to that extreme measure. So now we're kind of exploring, trying to find out what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, and see if there are any foods that have individual problems. How many episodes would you think he had in total of this? What would your guess be?
I'd say a dozen, but only the last three have been severe, and you know, it really is painful.
Yeah, no, it's very, very. Does he have an antibiotic he's put on right away when it happens?
Yes, he has a standing prescription for just what you said, Augmentin, and we keep it on hand for any.
And you can, and it's in your house, right?
Yes.
Good, because you always want to be able to start it. You don't want to be in the middle of the countryside and say, "Gee, we left the Augmentin at home, and we have to start it." You want to be able to start it right away.
Yes.
Great. Well, good luck. That's what I would do. High fiber, Metamucil, those would be good steps.
Dr. Zorba, can I ask about the alcohol portion?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, alcohol doesn't really affect it one way or another. You know, so
okay.
He can certainly have, I'm assuming you mean a drink or two of alcohol.
Well, I think that when the drinking becomes immoderate, it actually triggers the situation.
Yes, yes. Immoderate drinking is not something that a doctor tends to recommend. I think you should engage in immoderate drinking because it's good for your health. It's not exactly the way that it works, but yes. Immoderate drinking would not be good and really isn't good for anyone who has any intestinal problems. So that's 1 to 2 drinks a day. That's what that means. Except
okay.
When the Packers are playing, then you can take a little more.
Does she care about the Packers in Sandpoint, Idaho?
Come on, the Packers. It's worldwide. It's worldwide. Thanks for your call.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Before we head out today, Zorba, let's read an email from a listener named Jeff. He writes, "First off, I absolutely love your show. On a recent show, you were talking about an incident with a caller being attacked by a household bobcat. I was wondering if it could have been a pixie bob. Pixie bobs are a domesticated version of a bobcat and are bred with house cats. My neighbor has 2 of them, and they look exactly like a bobcat but are totally harmless. They are extremely playful and love to jump out on people. unlike a house cat, they require a lot of attention and stimulation. They will play fetch, and you can put them on a leash and take them for a walk. They do have the extra appendage on the paws, and you have to keep their nails in check. I had never heard of such a critter until they got one, then 2. They are extraordinarily expensive and look scary, but they are harmless. Again, thanks for making my day more fun."
Well, I have to tell you, they sent us a picture, and we'll put this picture up on the website. Can we do that,
Carl? Let me hold it in front of the microphone.
Keep holding it there. No, and a little bit to the right.
Okay.
You got it.
I got to say, if this thing jumped on me, I'd be a little scared.
This is a big puppy. This looks about the size of your dog. It almost looks like the size of my dog.
My dog is a very big bastard.
I know. So I would, if this thing jumped on me, the first thing I would say is, I would scream, "Get this off of me." So playful to the, what are they, Dixie Bob cat?
Pixie.
Well, this doesn't look like a pixie to me. This looks like something bigger than a pixie. I love these photos.
Have a tip for us? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or post it on Facebook.
Don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0812Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.